sweetness which I do see. In the thought by might of God, in the thought by might of God, I taste thy name, so sweet, so sweet. Devotee knows how sweet you are, devotee knows how sweet you are. Thou art my life, thou art my love, thou art the sweetness which I do see. Thou art my life, thou art my love, thou art the sweetness which I do see. Thou art my life, thou art my love, thou art the sweetness which I do see.
Let's sing Shri Guru Deva Om, and we'll try this again. We tried it at the kirtan. With the women singing with me, the men singing with Panduranga. We don't usually do chants this way, but if you feel, one way to think of it is after you sing, feel as if, as the others are singing, that energy of the song is going deeper into yourself. And we'll sing the first part. Swami has us singing that a number of times, and then the second part less. So follow me as best you can. Shri Guru Deva. Shri Guru Deva.
Shri Guru Deva. Oh,
Let's pray together. Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Friend, beloved God,
Jesus Christ,
Babaji Krishna,
Lahiri Mahashaya,
Swami Sri Yukteswar,
beloved Guru,
Paramahansa Yoganandaji, we humbly bow to you all. Beloved Masters,
guide and help us
on this pilgrimage
to thy light,
to thy joy,
to thy love.
We are thine.
Be thou ours.
Om. Peace.
Amen.
Please be seated.
Do we need these lights on for the video, or is it okay? Okay.
All on the help of the Pandavas, who are represented by the conch.
Some of them seem to be just waking up.
Since we've called on the Pandavas and our class this morning is on meditation, let's also call on Krishna.
I heard your flute high on a cloud. Your call I can't resist. Oh, let me come and play with you. We'll scatter music with the dew and sound the morning mist. I've heard you piping on a hill. All else I've set aside. Oh, let us dance the mountain peaks. We'll skip with breezes on the creeks and soar the valleys wide. Your flute has called me to the fields. Now I've no place to live. Don't send me back, rejected friend. Whatever I call mine must end. All that I am, I give. I hear your call in every tree, in every flower and stream, and sweetest melody of all, a song that heaven's joy recalls. Here in my heart, you see.
Krishna's flute within for meditation. Good morning, everyone. It's been a nice trip, hasn't it, so far? This morning, Devi and I want to talk about the subject of meditation and techniques, and especially those techniques that we use in order to bring us to the goal that we're all seeking, which ultimately, of course, is union with God. Master said that defined meditation as deep concentration on God or on one of the aspects of God. Aspects of God are eight. There's light, sound, wisdom, joy, love, peace, calmness, and power. So meditation is when the mind is complete. True meditation, deep meditation, is when the mind is deeply focused, concentrated on God or on one of those aspects. Until that time, we're working at trying to get to deep meditation. Now, all of us, everyone, struggles with a restless mind. It's just part of the way that creation is made, because as we come in to a body, and into a body with senses, and the appearance of a world outside of ourself, it is natural that our life force and our concentration and our attention get drawn outside. And the result of that is the appearance that there is something outside of us and there is us. And that's part of the ego, that the essence of the ego is that we think that I am this body and personality. Soul identified with that is the ego. And as soon as we separate into an ego, we exclude all the trillions and trillions of other possibilities of what we could be. And so what we're trying to do through meditation is to break that exclusivity of the ego, the limitation. Swamiji called the ego a bundle of self-definitions. Well, no matter how big your bundle is, it still excludes all the billions of other self-definitions that you might be able to have, and in fact are. And so meditation is meant to break that bondage or that delusion of the ego. And one of the difficulties that we all deal with is the fact that our minds are restless and our energy is outwardly directed. And so meditation is not so much an end in and of itself, but it is a set of tools to allow us to achieve that goal. Now, workmen in any industry, they have a kind of set of terminology that makes it possible to communicate. Dr. Peter, being a physician, has thousands of words and terms that are specialized to being a physician so that he can describe things in the world of medicine. The difficulty with English in terms of meditation is it doesn't give us much of a vocabulary. It doesn't allow us much subtlety in perceiving how our minds are restless or why our minds are restless. And so I want to address that a little bit today. I read a very interesting section of a book by Malcolm Gladwell. I think it was the book Outliers, I'm not sure. At any rate, he talked about two sisters who had extremely sensitive taste sensibilities. But not only that, they had worked up a language so that they could communicate to each other about the tastes that they were tasting. Now, you and I don't have much language. You know, it was sour, it was sweet, it was salty, it was hot, it was cold. That pretty much ends it, you know. These two sisters worked for, I think it was Dorito. Frito-Lay. They could taste a chip, say a tortilla chip. They could tell what factory it came from, what time of day it was produced, and how long it had been in a package. And they had that not only because they had the sensitivity of taste, but they had the language that they could express those things so that they could communicate. You know, the wine connoisseurs have a kind of a language. You know, it's oaky, it's fruity, it's sweet, it's sour, it's dry, it's earthy. Now, they don't have that language only so they can seem to be snooty. They probably have it for that reason, too. But it's not only for that. They want to communicate the subtleties of taste. So as I say, for meditation, English doesn't have much of a vocabulary. And Sanskrit has a much, much better vocabulary. But I suspect not a great percentage of the people in the room speak Sanskrit or have studied it sufficiently. So we have to begin, if we're going to work on this question of how to achieve union with God and what holds us back, we need to work a little bit more on having a way of communicating it. And that is why, in part, I had that story on Monday, which was the story of the journey that we take from the very beginning up to the point of being able to soar in the air, which, and having to land, but that represents sabhikalpa samadhi, going into samadhi, but then having to come back into the ego. And so I want to review a little bit of that story, because part of the reason that I wanted to, I don't know, it just came to me intuitively to have a class like that was to help give us not only a verbal language, but a visual language. You know, if you're after a culprit, you don't just say, well, he was a guy and he kidnapped some people. Well, what did he look like? Well, you know, he was a guy and a kidnapper. So you don't just say, you know, I was trying to meditate and I was spaced out. Well, what kind of spaced out? Well, you know, spaced out. That's about the level of vocabulary that most of us have for describing our difficulties with meditation. And so when the police are after a culprit, they try to get a picture and a description, and that helps them narrow it down so that they can differentiate this person from a lot of others. So I want to try today to talk about how we get a language, both verbal and visual, to help us understand the difficulties, the culprits that we're facing in meditation, and how to work with that. And that was what the story was about. So let me go through that story again and add kind of verbal meditational descriptions to those segments. So as you remember, the first part of the story was the Disneyland entrance and then the walk to the first stop and then having to tithe from what you have, and then the start of the next day where you brought all your goods and you had to go upstairs, so you had to leave your shopping carts. So that is kind of like the first segment of what people approaching the spiritual path are faced with. Now, first of all, simply being on a pilgrimage is an unusual state. Not many people, not a very large percentage of the people in the world, want to take a pilgrimage. As Master put it to Norman, he said, who was kind of rueing the fact that, I don't know, that he had a little tendency toward depression, and he was thinking, oh, I'm not a very good devotee, and so on. And Master said, remember, it takes very, very, very good karma even to want to know God. And so even the people coming to that entrance and getting on the path have very, very very good karma because they're on the path. Now, all of us are on that path, and we're probably way past those staircases. And so it's what I'm going to talk about is meditation of the type that takes us to samadhi. But there's a danger in doing that because we're all going to feel guilty because we haven't gotten there yet. And absolutely, absolutely, let's put that aside. It's really a ripening process. Do you go down and shake your finger at a tree of green apples because they aren't ripe yet? So it's just a ripening process. One time we were with Swamiji. I mean, he says profound things in somewhat absurd places. This was in Arden Fair Mall in Sacramento. And we had been in Nordstrom's and came out, and we were walking down the hall. And he kind of stopped and he said, I got a letter from someone yesterday praising me for all the things that I've done. And he said, I know that people praise me for all the things I've done, but I wish they would just realize that it's because I've been at it a little bit longer than they have. Everybody will do everything that they want to do. And so he was saying, you know, it's not that anyone is created special. As soon as you think you're created special, all you do is enhance the power of the ego that separates you. And so everybody is created out of God. We're all just aspects of God. We're just God playing different roles. And one of the dangers on the spiritual path is comparing your role with other people's roles, and either putting yourself above other roles or beneath other roles. They're both equally dangerous or absurd. And so we're working on a ripening process. And so the first part of that journey, we come to a point in the spiritual path where we realize that we have to give back to the source of what we have received. And so that was what the tithing was about, that we have to give 10% of our tokens. Because what are we going to receive? We're going to receive everything. We don't have to carry food. We don't have to carry water. We don't have to carry anything. Clothing we receive, the path itself is there for us. So it's all provided for us. But in order to continue on that path, we have to offer back to the source of that path the things that we think are ours. That's why I had that little group come out from Swami's description of the rebellion in the story of the bird and say, what else is wisdom if not to keep what ours for ourselves? What is ours for ourselves? And so when we have that attitude, then we have the attitude of poverty or restriction or not having enough. And we carefully count out little things. To get rid of that attitude, you can't count out little things forever and ever. You have to just give it away. And when you give it away, then you can continue to give away 100% every day from then on into infinity. When you're counting out the number of tokens you're going to give, you're going to always, always have a sense of limitation. You can't go into samadhi with a sense of limitation because samadhi by its definition is the breaking of limitation. So that's one of the first steps, is that you have to offer back what you have to the source from which you've received it. And what do you have? Everything you have. What do you need to offer back? Everything. Because it's all God's in the first place. We only have one bundle of self-definition that makes us think this is mine and not yours. So we have to throw away that little twig in our bundle and get rid of it. Then we proceed on and we come to the stairs. And that's meant to say that we can't proceed very far on the path if we have a lot of attachments. And so we move on. We have to move through those attachments. And then this first section of the journey, you know, we come together in a group, a satsang like this. We travel the path with other people who are traveling. It's joyful. We can move along the path. We can skip if we want. We can dance if we want. It's a very joyful time. But we have to be open to allow others to be a part of that. And that's basically what Master and Swamiji wanted us to do in the creation of community. As long as we're moving along on a pilgrimage to God, it is easier, more enjoyable, and faster if we do it as a group than if we do it alone. And so it's very good on that to have some sort of group that you move with. Now, is it necessary? No. There were still other people walking along that path alone or however they wanted to walk. And so it's not necessary, it's just a help. So community satsang is a help. What is the other help that is even more important? A guide. That's why Walker was there. That's why each night he sang songs to lift our spirits. He gave us teachings so that we would understand, and so on. So how long does that process take? That's why I started out saying time is stretchy. That process to where you get up to having to cleanse yourself and take the exam, realistically, it takes, I don't know, dozens of lifetimes. I mean, Swami asked Master, because Norman had a vision of being with Master in Lemuria, and which is tens of thousands of years ago, just apparently mythical, but probably a real civilization. And Norman had a vision of being with Master, and Swamiji got a little frightened by that, or concerned, I shouldn't say frightened, concerned. And he said, Master, have I been with you for thousands of years? And Master said, it's been a long time, that's all I'll say. So how long does that process of being with the guide and walking along, getting to the point where we're ready to be cleansed of everything? Takes a long time, that's all I'll say. But the fact that we're wanting to get there, that is much more important than anything else. See, we're always headed toward where our intention is. If our intention is to find God, that is the single most important factor of all on the spiritual path. Because as long as we keep that attention and mend it and feed it and continue to have it grow, it will direct and guide our entire existence. All the details will fall into place around whatever your intention is. So working on your intention is extremely important. And that's part of the cleansing process, part of the ripening process. And there's no sense in beating yourself up if you have slightly other intentions or you haven't completely focused, you haven't achieved yet deep concentration on God or on one of His aspects. Why beat yourself up? It's just a ripening process. Eventually we will come to the point, not out of a sense of duty or drudgery or someone outside of ourselves forcing us, we will come to a point where other desires other than wanting God, just begin to fall away. Why? Because we've tried them and seen that they don't work. Then we tried them again, thinking maybe this variation on it will work. And we've tried them again and again for millions and millions of lives until we get to the point, as Master said, where there's an anguishing sense of monotony. And when that anguishing sense of monotony comes, you don't need somebody to shake their finger and say, I'm the teacher and I told you, you have to give those up. You're desperate to give them up. You don't want them. And maybe they trail along for a little time, but they can't stay with you very long as your intention is clear in where you're moving. Okay, so then along this pilgrimage, we come to the point where we have to cleanse ourselves and bathe and leave every possession and everything behind. Go into the locker room, change into a completely new set of clothing, new body, whatever we need, and then take the exam. And as you know, the exam was, I had fun with it. Let's admit it. But it was all blank pages, except for one single question. And that question was true or false. From now on, I embrace the fact that that my only goal in life is the search for God. Now, you can't go into samadhi until you can answer yes to that question. And if you don't, that's why it's said on the cover of the book, you can come back and take this exam as often as you want. And so you have to be truthful, because your karma is going to force you to be truthful. You can't fake it. And so you come around and around and around. You come back on that path. You don't have to go back to the entrance, but you go back to the, I don't know, bridge over the stream, and then you come back. But you come back as often as need be until you can answer that question honestly, because you can't go into the kind of meditation that will lead you to samadhi if you're still holding on to attachments or desires for something other than God. You can certainly go into deep meditations, and that's part of the cleansing process. You do that again and again. Now, the last part after that were the stages of deep meditation. And I actually forgot one part, and I should have put it in because it's very important. So I'm going to tell it now as if it were in. I'll remind you, we went through the part where the path was slippery and there was shale on the other side. You'd slide down and have to get up. Then we went back through the howling winds. And then I had us go directly to the, you know, to the walls where everything was scraped off. But there's an interim step, and it's important to do that. So here's the story that continues. So after the howling winds settled down, then we came into a kind of a plateau. And that plateau was filled with thickets and trees and shrubs. And the path, which up until now had been very clear, became difficult to follow. There'd be a path that looked like it would lead to the right place, and then there would be three or four choices, and you would take one of those paths, and you'd follow it along, and it would lead you into a thicket that was impenetrable, kind of like the mentations of your mind. So you'd have to retrace your steps, and then you'd try another one, and that would lead you into a swamp where your feet were stuck. It was very hard to walk, kind of like sticky emotions. And you'd lead into other ones that led to a cliff where you couldn't go any farther, and so on. And it was very difficult to make progress in this plateau until I remembered, again, the advice of Walker, who said, when in doubt, look to the light and follow that. And I noticed that every time there was a choice, one of those paths had more light at the end of it. And so when I followed that, it led me quite quickly out of that tangled plateau. And that led me to the cliffs where the where you had to scrape through. Okay, so now let's come back and I'll talk about how this applies, these four parts, how they apply to meditation, to the search for God, what they mean, and why they're in this sequence. Because they actually also apply to Patanjali's Eightfold Path. One could say that up until you take the exam, you're working primarily on the yamas and the niyamas. And the two aspects are really, you could say that the five yamas, or those things that you should not do, those are just representative of all the ways we let our energy go into things that are detrimental to the spiritual path and that will hold us back. But they're, you know, they're nonviolent. So you can't be violent. You can't lie. You can't cheat. You can't steal. You can't be overly sensual. And you can't be greedy. But there are many others. You know, Duryodhana had 100 brothers. Duryodhana represents king material desire, and his brothers represent all of those other things that you should apply yama to. And then there's niyama, and that is the power to follow those things that are good for you and will help release you. And in the Mahabharata, Sahadev represents yama, the power to avoid wrong action. And Nakula represents the five Pandavas, chakras, represents the power of niyama and yama. Yama and niyama. So Nakula is niyama, where you should let your energies flow. And so let's say that the first part of the path we walk with Nakula and Sahadev, because we have to get to a point where, if not perfected in it, at least our behavior patterns are such that we don't spend all of our time in damage control. Because otherwise, how much energy do we have left to go on to real release into God? Okay, so yama, niyama. Then after the exam, we come into the first part of the path, which is wet and slippery, and it's got the shale on the side, you know, that you easily slip off and you slide down that shale and then you have to scramble back up. That represents the beginning stage of meditation when the mind is still very restless. And slipping off, the mind is slippery. And it will slide off and slide off. If I had an extended version, I would say one of the things that I learned on that is that as soon as I started to slip, I grabbed onto a rock, and then I didn't slip. So as soon as the mind begins to wander, you grab onto something, you grab onto your point of focus, and then you don't have to slide down and clamber back up. And so what are the techniques that help us through that beginning stage of meditation when our minds are slippery, especially slippery? Well, Hong Saw is what Master has given us. Remember I said, I learned that Walker said when you get centered in the spine and relaxed, that then you don't slip off so much. So Hong Saw centers us in the spine. The very mantra itself withdraws the energy into the astral spine and helps concentrate us at the spiritual eye, which is where we're completely centered, where the goal is. Another technique that could be used there would be listening to Om or chanting or any of the techniques that bring us in and center us. And so everything that centers us will bring us to the standpoint of one relaxation brings us to Patanjali's path of asana, where we can sit completely still, because physical tension is one of the enemies, one of the culprits. So if we were naming things that cause us difficulties, one of the names would be, I'm tense. I'm moving around a lot. I'm not relaxed. That's one of the culprits. And if we have a name for it and understand it and recognize it, it's easier to say, okay, oh, I know how to cure that. I just need to relax more. Or we would say, my mind is slippery. It's slipping off here. What can I do about that? Let me concentrate more on the mantra Hong Saw, on the feeling of breath, on the spiritual eye. Let me get centered in the spine, because that will help me. And if, as will always happen, because that stage is slippery, if my mind begins to slip away, let me grab onto something really quick, rather than letting my mind slip down a long ways. And that will help us get through that section. The next section is the swirling winds. What swirling winds represent is energy, our prana, swirling around. And what we need to do for deeper meditation is to make that swirling outward-directed prana settle down and come within. And what is the primary technique there? Do you remember from the story how we got through that part? We started doing Kriya. And so Kriya calms down those winds. That's prana that's outward. Kriya brings that prana inward and into the spine and brings it under our control. And when we do that, everything else calms down. Now we can, as I said in the story, we can make the noise go away by using the mind to repeat God, 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 or to chant, or to listen to Om. That makes the noise go away. Well, Om brings the energy inward, but verbal repetition brings it inward to a certain extent, but the verbalizing mind at a farther point is going to be an obstacle, not a help. And so we can use that as a tool, knowing that we're going to have to abandon that tool. So in meditation, when we're trying to meditate deeply, we can indeed use the mind to pray to God or to sing or to talk to God. But we have to realize that at some point we have to abandon that. And if we can concentrate completely on Kriya, it brings the energy more deeply within and more deeply up in the spine. And so that's the reason for the practice of Kriya. Now, if in deep meditation we're completely focused on our Kriya, then we pass beyond the need to fight those swirling winds, this swirling energy. What's next after Kriya? Most of you have the technique of Kriya. What do we do after the technique of Kriya? We do Jyoti Mudra and we try to look into the light. And so that's why it was actually an important part of this journey to talk about the tangled paths, because after Kriya, the mind still wants to fiddle around and move different directions and think about projects or whatever. You know, mind will finish our Kriyas and we'll begin thinking about what am I going to make for breakfast. Well, cooking breakfast is a good activity. You just don't want to do it in your meditation room. And so set that aside, and because I say that and it's a joke, But I don't know if you've ever had the thought that your mind is kind of thinking of projects during meditation, and you think, oh, this is fine, because they're projects having to do with helping Ananda or helping my spiritual path or whatever. They're good in and of themselves. It's just, as I say, you don't want to cook your breakfast in your meditation room, and you don't want to do your projects. You don't want to write the master plan in your meditation room. Now, I don't know whether you guys who have been working on this for 3 years have brought the master plan into your meditation room or not. But it doesn't get you to the end point. Clears out karma, though. Okay, so we follow the light, and following the light, when we do that, then we come out to the last place that we have to get through. Now, the scraping of the walls was meant to indicate the scraping off of all egoic identification. All those bundles of self-definition get scraped away. And if they don't get scraped away, you can't soar into the skies of samadhi. So you have to go through this process of allowing them to get scraped away. One of the things I could have added in there, but the story was already getting long, was that the more you relax into that, the less you resist, the easier it is to go through that process. So the less you hold on to the definitions of ego, the less you want, the less your intent is to hold on. The intent at that time should be to come out completely cleansed and completely cleansed of holding on to any, scraped clean of everything, so that you come out. And when you do that, then the spiritual eye appears before you, and the next stage of the process is not just to look at it, because if we're still looking, it means that the prana is centered in the medulla. It means that we still have an eye and a spiritual eye and a process of looking at that. You have to go into and through the spiritual eye. And when you do that, the energy, the life force, the kundalini, literally moves from the medulla into the spiritual eye, and we become released out of that. It's at that point that we come out onto the plane. We could call it the astral plane, but in deep, deep meditation, it's beyond the astral plane, because the astral plane still contains ego. But we come out onto a plane that is absolutely gorgeous, absolutely fulfilling, and there we can soar into the skies of samadhi. Now that's the kind of vocabulary and visual aids to help us clarify where we're going and the stages along that journey. But then in sabbikalpa samadhi, we still come back to the ego. And so we want to get beyond that. But even at that point, we haven't become completely cleansed. And so we fly over the mountain. We come back to the starting point, the origin. The origin of us is that we are Satchitananda. That's our origin. It isn't the ego. It isn't separation. We come back to that point. But if we can't hold on to that realization at that point, then we'd better go push some carts. Meaning we'd better go help and continue this journey again and again and again until we finally come to the point of complete realization in it. And so with this, I hope that it will help to have a little bit more language, a little bit more clarity on the stages of the journey and on the goal of the journey. And I hope that we all pass through in that spiritual eye and soar. Maybe we get to soar together.
so humble.
Well, our class this morning is still a little too loud. Our class this morning is, as we've been saying, on how we can look at the techniques as stages on our inner journey, the techniques of meditation. And I was so happy to be able to talk about this because I get to share one of my very, very favorite quotes from Master. I found this, it's in one of his talks, and when I came upon it, it stopped me in my tracks, and and this was some years ago, but Master said, and we'll talk about it in a little more depth, quote now, "I remember the day when for the first time, unlooked for, from behind the clouds of the drudgery of routine meditating habits, there burst upon my consciousness the aurora of bliss. It surpassed all my expectations, joy indescribable." And there's so much in that simple few sentences for our encouragement, our inspiration, our hope, our guidance for walking the spiritual path. I just want to touch on some of the aspects that are so meaningful to me. "I remember the day when for the first time," Master said, and I sat and I thought about it. The day, Master, how many lifetimes ago, how many, many lifetimes ago, that day came to him for the first time. And I thought, we think of the gurus as sort of ready-made packages. They came that way. Just add water and there they are. But they had that moment when for the first time this experience came. Another part of the quote, "unlooked for. God comes like a thief in the night." I don't know about you, but sometimes I've been having a terrible meditation. Just my mind is restless and preoccupied, and then boom, unlooked for. It's like God's presence is there. Where did you come from? Why did you come now when I'm just being so unreceptive in this moment, but unlooked for? And so to live our lives in that way, that God comes, as Christ said, like a thief in the night. We don't know when that moment will come. And so to live each day in expectation, will you come today? You know, it's like a little kid or all of us when we order something from the internet and, oh, will it come today? Will it come today? And then maybe you get the note that says back ordered, or maybe you get the note that says no longer available. But we hope, and just that thought, unlooked for, to just keep living our lives in such a way that we think, today might be the day God comes, each day, to wake up with that thought. And if we do that, it will happen. So unlooked for, from behind, Master says, from behind the clouds of the drudgery, great word, drudgery, of routine meditating habits, the drudgery of the routine of meditation. Get up, tired, not stomach a little upset because we ate too much pizza last night. Got to sit down there and do the drudgery of routine meditating habits. Master was there. It's not just us. That's why I love this. Master was there, and he lived that. And it gives us the hope that that drudgery of routine meditating habits, when you get into that space, try to remember, Master was here. And if you can simply remember that, it breaks the whole hold of that consciousness. We need to be regular. Master said the secret to freedom is intensity of effort and duration of effort, duration, on and on. And that duration can be anguishing monotony at times. How many times have I called on you? How many times has there been no answer? But remember what we said on Monday. Master said, every single time we meditate, we decrease the hold that karma has on us. Every time. And so we can think of it in one of two ways. We can think of, here I go again. Or we can think of it, maybe today's the day. And even if it's not the day when I go to bed at night, I will have taken a next step closer to that goal of the inner journey by simply moving, putting one foot in front of the other on the path. So the from behind the clouds of the drudgery of routine meditating habits, there burst upon my consciousness the aurora of bliss. That moment. Just to live in the knowledge, in the faith that that moment where that aurora of bliss bursts upon our consciousness. And sometimes we can almost taste it. Sometimes it's very close. And we start, someone was telling me, and I've heard this, I'm sure all of you have worked with newer people on the path, have heard this often and often. In fact, the person I heard it from, there was a woman, very nice young woman, who 10 years ago used to cut my hair. She had a little salon in town. She was a nice woman. She had difficult karma, and she moved away, but she stayed in touch with me, and she calls me from time to time, and we taught her how to meditate. And she called me Monday, honestly. We had gotten home from the class. We had a lot to do. She called me, "Hi, this is Rebecca. I've been meditating, and I just went into the light, and it scared me so much that I'm afraid to meditate anymore." And I said, "Rebecca, don't be afraid. The light is not, you are the light. And when you feel comfortable with the light, you'll open up to it again." But we all get those moments where we start to feel the aurora of bliss. And then we pull back and we say, "Oh, I'm really not ready yet, you know, and the master plan isn't done, and you know, all the things. And what about all the different little things we can decide? I have to sell that piece of property, I have to buy a present for my grandkid's birthday, whatever it is." And so we pull back, but that the bursting of that aurora of bliss, it will come in its own way, and the more we live in the expectation of that moment, when it comes, we'll say, we'll greet it as a friend. "I've been waiting for you for such a long time, such a long time." And that's the parable in the Bible of the foolish and the wise virgins. The wise virgins kept the candle, the wick of their oil lamps trimmed and filled with oil in waiting for coming of the bridegroom, of the Christ consciousness. But the foolish virgins fell asleep. And when the Christ consciousness came, they were not awake. But the wise virgins always kept the wick and their oil lamp filled. And that means we always live in expectation of that day when it burst upon our consciousness, the aurora of bliss. And as Master also says in Samadhi, it's the poem Samadhi, "It surpassed all my expectations, beyond expectation of imagination, bliss indescribable." And so Jyotish has been trying to give us a vocabulary, but there comes to a point where there is no vocabulary. It's simply indescribable, and it's something eternally familiar, eternally ours. And we just have to walk in on this inner journey in the footsteps of those who have gone before us and who have shown us the way and who have experienced each stage, from the drudgery of routine meditating habits to the expectation to the bursting of the aurora of bliss on their consciousness. That's why they came, and that's why we came. I remember once Swamiji saying at a talk, "You don't understand, but I need you just as much as you need me, because I need to fulfill my journey by bringing you along with me. And so they've come to help us. We've come to be helped until we get to the point where we also, everything I do, Christ said, you too can do and more. And so don't think of yourselves as other than what the goal of this inner journey. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit now about why we have meditative techniques on this path, and how we can best work with them. And because they're given to us as tools to move forward on the path. And of course, the first basic rule of meditation is learn how to do it. Learn how to do it well. You know, we were giving a class some years ago when we started the center in San Francisco. Remember we told you about that evening? So we were, when we were walking on the streets of San Francisco with Swami. So one evening we were giving a class at a nice church in San Francisco. Jyotish was teaching it, and I was going to go in and help, but I had a little table out in front of the room, and I was signing people up and so forth. And we'd sent out a mailing. And this woman, these two women came up, and they were very well-dressed, kind of church ladies, you know, and, you know, kind of upper crust San Francisco. And they came up, and they said, oh, what's this class you're offering? And I said, well, it's a class on meditation. And they kind of looked a little disappointed, and they said, oh, meditation, we already did that. And I had to really keep a nice smile on my face and not make some snide remark. But but in any case, I don't know, it's not enough to learn meditation. Oh, I went to a class on Hong Sa. I think probably all of us who were here in the early years, we heard Swami give dozens and dozens of classes on the Hong Sa technique alone. And it was always different, and I always got something else out of it. So learn the techniques, but then review them, and study them, and go deeper with them. I really, when I read or listen to a talk of Swami's on any of the techniques, I think, I never heard that before, because I wasn't ready to hear it before. I wasn't deep enough into the practice to understand the vocabulary he was using, because it was symbolic. And until you're there, it's just words. But if you keep trying to study and go deep and deep, and if you have questions about it, ask people. Ask people who have been on the path a little bit longer than you have. I ask Jyotish all the time, well, is this the higher kriya? Is it this or that? And don't be embarrassed. It's these techniques, this is sort of a funny word, but they're self-revelatory. They reveal themselves. And so the more you do them, the more you think, oh my gosh, I never got that before. And no one's teaching you, you're just getting it from within, the gurus are teaching us. But if you have a question, ask people. Don't be afraid to look dumb. We're all dumb. And just go as deep as you can. Make the study and practice of the techniques the first priority in your life. Everything else you do, fine. But if however many hours you spend reading interesting articles on the internet about whatever, study the techniques. Go deep in them, and then practice them. Practice them as though for the first time. Oh, I didn't ever understand that. Let me try to do this when I practice Hong Sa. Let me try to get in this slightly different position with my arms when I do the higher kriya, the second kriya, and so forth. And so keep refining, deepening, studying your technique. And then, again, have people who are more experienced than you review your practice, kriya, and the other techniques. Don't be embarrassed. If you've been here 50 years, don't be embarrassed to say, am I doing this right? Because it's subtle stuff. And, you know, I see a lot of people doing the third and fourth kriya improperly in group meditations. It's not just twirling your head around, it's giving a psychic blow to each of the chakras. And if you just twirl your head around, you'll get some energy, but it's not doing it properly. So review the techniques and watch, ask people, am I doing this right? I remember, I just love this story, when Narayan, who's the head of our group, our center, with his wife, the co-spiritual director, with his wife Dharma Devi in Los Angeles, when he first got Kriya, he was working on Wall Street. He had a very lucrative job with Bloomberg and in New York on Wall Street. He'd just gotten Kriya, and he so much wanted to get it right. This was when Dhyana was here and in charge of the Kriya ministry. He would call Dhyana on his cell phone. He said, look, I'm walking down Wall Street. I'm going to slip into an alley here. Listen to my Kriyas. Am I doing them right? And she would check his Kriyas on his cell phone from Wall Street. But so much he wanted to get it right. And then also, very, very important in the practice of our techniques, don't mix your techniques with other paths. If you've learned things before you came here, you just have to say that was another line of training. Or if you pick up something along the way since you've been here, it will not help you. And I'm saying this not for any self-interest, but simply to help you. It will not help you to practice other techniques. I remember a very strong lesson I had early on in the path. I had been here just not very long, maybe, well, longer than I would like to admit, maybe a few years. Swami was, and I had Kriya and I was practicing our techniques, but Swamiji was giving a talk in San Francisco at a big conference. I think it was called Meeting of the Ways. And there were many other spiritual teachers also presenting. And it, we were there for 3 or 4 days. And one evening, Swamiji wasn't doing a public talk. He was just having some time just to rest and be by himself. And one of the other presenters, then these were spiritual souls. This was a very, very fine man, Indian spiritual teacher called Sankshavadas. And he was giving kind of an informal satsang at the large home of one of his disciples in the Bay Area. And so a group of us from Ananda went, and he gave a nice discourse. And then afterwards he said, now I want you all, there's a little side room, I want you all to come in, and I'm going to give each one of you a mantra. And I thought, well, I don't need a mantra. I have my own path. And so when we all were lining up and it was my turn, I said, you know, I don't really feel this is right for me to get this mantra because I have my own path. He said, oh, no, no, it's okay. We'll only help you. So I took the mantra and I went home, and several weeks went by. And I happened to be with Swamiji, and I just very casually mentioned that Sankshavadas had given me this mantra. He got very firm about it. And he just said, well, now's a fine time to tell me. How long have you been doing this? And I said, well, Swami, I didn't know it was wrong. And he said, well, it is wrong because it's a different vibration and it will dilute your practice of the techniques. He was very strong with me. And I forgot the mantra. I mean, it was like, it shook it out of me. But I'm not saying this to be sectarian. I'm only saying it because it's a spiritual principle. That it's sort of like using the analogy of a pilgrimage. You've got a guide. The guide is the guru. The guru, just as we said, remember Swamiji yesterday? He saw each one of us in the path that we were going to follow to find God. The guru looks at you and said, this is what you need. Trust me. But if somebody else comes along and follow this path, you'll get to the goal. Somebody else says, you know, there's another way to get there. Of course that's true. But if you leave your path and go off on that way, you'll lose traction. And so it mixing the vibrations dilutes the practice of our own techniques. And this is more important for new people than people who have been on the path for a long time. But remember that. It's not, you may think, oh, wow, here's another tool in my bag of tricks. It only dilutes what we're trying to do because the techniques ultimately are not techniques. They're not things we do. They are vibrations that we try to align our consciousness with. And that's why meditation is hard, because it's not something you do. It's an alignment of a vibration. And if we dilute that vibration, it will keep superficial in our practice of yoga. So it's very important. My eye just caught Bhagavati and Ramesha, who are in a very wonderful way, who are in charge of our music ministry, head of our music ministry. Why, people ask, do you only sing Swami's music? Isn't there nice music? Yes, there is. And it's nice that we can listen to other music. But when we're in an environment where we are sharing the teachings or sharing the vibration, then we do Swami's music, because it takes us deeper into that vibration. So it all ties together. And so these are the practices and how we can use our techniques. And then how do each of our techniques help us on our journey? Energization. What's the wonderful prayer we do every day? Divine Mother, recharge my body with thy cosmic energy, my mind with thy concentration and determination. And I know that I've not had a good night's sleep when I can't remember that part of the prayer. Now, what is it that my mind's supposed to do? Concentration and determination, and my soul with thy ever-new joy. That's the beginning of it all. That's the beginning of the journey, and it's why it's so great to do them every morning when we first wake up, because every day is a pilgrimage. Every day is an inner journey. And if we, as the energization exercise teaches us, if we learn to be aware of the flow of life force, and then even more remarkable, understand that we can control and direct that life force, we have that momentum to keep moving forward no matter what comes on that journey. And then Hong Saw, the concentration that keep us focused on the goal. No matter what distractions happen, if we can keep concentrating. And you know, it was so beautiful watching Swami, who had such a concentrated mind. And at first, when he would write, in the first decade or so of his writing, it would take him a long time to write a book. I think some of them in the New Path, formerly known as The Path, that took him almost a year. But then it was like he had so honed that concentration of the mind that those books just started coming forth. We were there in India when he wrote my two favorite books of his are The New Path and The Essence of the Bhagavad Gita. But when he was writing The Essence of the Bhagavad Gita, he wrote that in 3 months. We were there for the first two. And every day he said, my goal is to write 30 pages every day. Every day he would come down and he would have those pages and he would read them to us. But the concentration, which is a reflection of Hong Sao, was so integrated into his being that there wasn't any effort anymore to concentrate. It was just concentration. And you could feel that. You could just feel the power. What a blessing it was to be in that house, the ashram there, living when he was writing that book. And then Om, the expansion. How does this help us on the path, on the journey, the inner pilgrimage? Because it's the dissolution of the ego. It's the understanding, I am a part of something so much greater. I am a part of all that is. And the more we can expand beyond the ego and cut that cord which ties the bundle of self-definition together, that's what the Om does. It's like, oh, I was at this and I was at that and this, then, and then you cut the cord, and all those little sticks, those little elements of the self-definition, they just all fall down. And you realize, but then who am I? I am the vibration of the universe. That's all I ever was. And then finally, Kriya. We come, and that brings it all together, where we use the directing of life force, the concentration, the expansion, and we magnetize the inner spine. We illumine the path before us. You know, when you're on an airplane, we're going to be getting on one shortly, and there's those little lights that go along the center aisle in case of emergency, just follow those little lights. Well, Kriya illumines the path for us so that we have the discrimination, the willpower, the determination, the concentration, all of those things to keep moving forward on the journey. And then finally, what do we do after we do Kriya, after we do Jyoti Mudra? People forget this. Lahiri Mahashaya talks about the calm, I love this phrase, the calm after effect poise. We sit in the silence of our own being. And ultimately, we've been talking about the importance of techniques. But ultimately, on the inner pilgrimage, we have to move beyond techniques. And we have to just rest in, we stop doing and just begin to practice a state of being, a state of communion with God. You know, there's a beautiful story from the life of Krishna. One of his gopis, so to say, was his favorite gopi. And his master explained, you know, we think of the dance of Krishna and the gopis, and it's depicted in romantic terms, but it wasn't that at all. Krishna was an avatar, and the gopis were enlightened sages that were absorbed in their devotion for God. And so someone comes to Radha once, and who was considered the most dear of the gopis, or one might say the most attuned of the disciples. And they ask her, Radha, why don't you ever practice yoga techniques? And she very humbly said, well, I would, but my mind is always so absorbed on my beloved Lord that I can't pull it away to do the techniques. And so every step on the journey, we can't ignore the techniques. We have to do them as well as we can. But ultimately, the goal is just to be absorbed in our love for God and God's love for us. As the beautiful line from one of the chants, the vast, unbeating heart of God, to reside there. And I just want to close this morning and our 3 days of classes by reading, I started out by reading from the first chapter of Swamiji's autobiography, The New Path, and now I want to read a page from the last chapter, and this is called The Final Goal. In fact, close your eyes and sit up. Oops, I'm missing this. The final goal. Paramahansa Yogananda taught us, above all, that the true goal of life is union with God. Devotion, self-offering, self-surrender, oneness in bliss, and divine love. These are the entire purpose of life. I lovingly remember one day when Master played a recording for a small group of us by a famous singer of Bengal, Mrinal Kanti Ghosh. It was a devotional song, Pashan Hoi. And these are the words in English. How long will you remain, Mother, a stone image before my gaze? Set fire ablaze in your eyes and come to me, dancing over all creation. O Mother, divine energy fills the universe with your flowing hair, garlanded by thoughts in all minds, dancing, dancing. O Mother, free me this day, this very moment, from delusion's bonds. Countless lives have I lived apart from you. At last now, bring peace into my body temple. Swami goes on, I don't remember all the words, and I am not conversant enough in Bengali to understand many of them. But I remember Master telling us afterwards, as I was listening, I too was dancing over all creation. Man's relationship with God is intimate and infinitely dear. What I've hoped above all in writing this book has been to convince you, dear reader, to live more deeply for God, to love Him so completely that you yourself become wholly absorbed in God. May we all receive and experience Swami's blessings for us in these words.